It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 388 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, Russell Brettholz is back, and listeners to this podcast will recognize him as the creator of a wonderful book called Sidekicked. What happens is sidekicks go on strike, which is something I've never read in a comic before, and we talk about how this book came to be, as well as the Kickstarter he has going on for Sidekicked issues 1 through 5. If you go to Kickstarter and look for Side-Kicked, you'll find it there. Russell talks about how the new issues are going to go places where even the first book hasn't gone. So I think you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode. So let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome back to the podcast Russell Brettholz, the writer and I believe creator of Sidekicked with a hyphen in there. How you doing, Russell?
I'm doing great, Wayne. It's a pleasure to be back.
Are you the creator and writer?
I write the series and I am the co-creator along with my original issue one penciler Miguel Mendoza, who had to unfortunately leave the book. But I say unfortunately, it's really only for me because now he's drawing at DC on a regular basis. So good for him. Not so much for me, though.
Well, you made it possible for him to go do that stuff by getting his name out there and his artwork out there. So good for him. That's always a good thing. I like to see indie people who move up through the ranks and be able to do good things.
Yeah, I knew he was going to break out, too. I was just hoping we'd be able to get the first series done before that happened. But so, still, great for him, though.
Yeah. Well, we're back to talk about Sidekicked again, which is a good stuff. You have a Kickstarter going for Sidekicked chapters 1 to 5. That's what we have on the website, which I've already pledged to, thankfully.
And I appreciate that. Thank you.
So I'm looking forward to getting that. I was just telling you, I loved Sidekicked. I thought it was one of those great books. It's one of those ideas that we should have thought of years ago, but luckily enough, you thought of it, and you made it happen. So I'm real happy with that because I loved that book. Was it four issues in Sidekick, the first volume?
Yeah, the first volume was 4 issues, and it told a complete story, which was very important to me. Of course, the problem to that was it was a complete story, and at no time during writing those first 4 issues did I consider, hey, I wonder what a sequel is going to be like, and maybe I should drop some little seeds that will eventually grow for the next thing. I didn't do that at all, which made writing the sequel actually very difficult.
I have to tell you, though, I was at Heroes Con recently, and all the people who worked at Heroes Con had the Heroes Con logo on their shirt, and what did it say underneath but Sidekick? And I kept thinking, oh man, they know this book is coming. They're promoting Sidekicked on their shirts there and everything. So I got a huge kick out of that. But it kept me in the mind to talk to you and to be able to get into the story and stuff. And the great thing too is you've made some of the story available to me, which even what I've just read so far has really got me fascinated. I'm just dying to see what's going to happen. My biggest trick is going to be not spoiling things. I'm just going to really work hard at not giving away any plot points or anything like that.
Well, the nice thing is, I shared with you the most of the details of the first issue of this new series, which is chapter 5. I'm terrible at naming things. This is something my publisher gets on me. He's like, really? You're going to call the first issue of this new series chapter 5? And I go, yeah. But so I consider that this is really, the act one. you know, if this was a movie, it would be the first 20 minutes. Everything would be in the trailer if it was a film. So I don't think we're really going to spoil anything if we talk about the plot points of this particular issue.
Okay. See, it's interesting to me, though, because, you know, this is naming, and I don't want to get too long into it, but there are a lot of people who have naming things very differently. I mean, like, there's one book I know called Solar Flare, and he goes by seasons. He has 5 issues in season 1, and then he goes to season 2, number 1. But there was several books that have gone that route, and I've found it difficult to keep track of what's what, you know. Trying to remember, there was a book that came out from Image that was that way, and
yeah, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer did that too in comic book form. Yeah. You know, because they were trying to say that this was the continuation of the TV show. So this wasn't, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer in the comics. This is season 8 of the TV show, or Angel season 6, or whatever it was, which I suppose works when you're trying to reach the television audience. Mm-hmm. But for comic books, you know, especially when you don't have a TV show that you're building off of, to consider what you're doing a season, I don't know. To me, it seems a little silly. If it works for them, that's great. But I certainly wouldn't consider it that way.
Well, see, it used to be in the days long gone now, we used to read 100 issues of a comic.
Yeah.
Now we're lucky if we can get to 52, you know, that we just don't get those kinds of things anymore. So my feeling is, if you love the book, you're going to keep track and you're going to get the next stuff, which is this book. Why don't you, for those people who may not have heard the previous interview, talk about what Sidekicked is about?
Sure. So the main events of the first volume, which is chapters 1 through 4, is the Sidekicks of Chicago get sick and tired of being disrespected by the heroes that they work for, so they go on strike. And when the villains find out, they exploit the opportunity to rain havoc down upon the city. This was very much born out of, oh gosh, it's now a long time ago, like 15 years ago, a little bit more than 15 years ago. I worked as an assistant to a financial planner, and I was very good at my job. Most of it was, just clerical stuff, but also fixing his mistakes and getting none of the credit for it. And then finally I was like, you know what? I don't want to be, you know, just an assistant anymore. I want to get put on a promotional track so I can, you know, basically, you know, do that job someday. And then I got fired just completely out of the blue, despite being as good as I was. And, you know, it occurred to me, I said, there's a story here. And, an assistant, you know, it made sense. And so Sidekicks to Superhero. And I thought, yeah, this is the story that would be easy to tell. And I've always wanted to write. You know, I used to dabble in fan fiction in high school and college and even after college. So being able to sit down and take a kind of a personal story, but give this superhero twist to it and make it something original in my own really appealed to me.
So I have to applaud you for getting fired and finding a good story in that. I would not. Now, I always have to tell the story. There was a guy I interviewed from the UK who was watching one of those movies where they talk about how things get. And they were talking about how they slaughtered pigs. And he came away with an idea for a comic. It was called Slaughterman's Creed. I'll never forget it. And I remember saying to him, I said, I don't know if I'd ever watch a movie or a documentary like that and come away with an idea for a comic book. So I can only, you know, admire that in somebody who actually takes something like that and turns it into a good story. I just admire that. I think that's the greatest thing. And because like I said, I loved Sidekick, that first storyline. That was just a wonderful thing.
You know, thank you.
How many times have we seen sidekicks that don't get the attention they deserve?
Yeah, and that was the thing for me. It's funny because I very much wrote the book in the style of a DC universe, even though I personally am more of a Marvel guy. You know, I really grew up more reading the X-Men more than anything else. And just for some reason, whatever it was, the DC comics never really spoke to me. It wasn't until I started writing that I realized that the archetypes that exist in DC, you know, the stoicism of their heroes, just really appealed to me as a writer. And it was much easier to play in that kind of a sandbox than trying to look at it from the Marvel perspective. You know, if I were to ask you to name like your top 5 favorite sidekicks, they're probably all going to be you know, either DC or, you know, some of the more independent stuff that's come out. Because Marvel, outside of Bucky, I don't know that I can really name a sidekick that exists in that world.
There was like Rick Jones.
Right, Rick Jones. There you go. So
yeah, so but you know, I was at a panel one time where people were talking about this very subject, about sidekicks and the fact that Marvel doesn't have any. You know, and I just got a huge kick. You know, we brought up a couple like the ones that we've just mentioned. But other than that, there's just not many of them out there. Because, you know, even Spider-Man started out as a young teenager.
Yeah, and Marvel really looked more at either just the individual heroes or the team-ups. You know, there was never this hierarchy of, well, I'm the superhero and you're just the sidekick. You know, even with Spider-Man, you know, who's really a good example, who, you know, it took a very long time for him to be considered an Avenger, you know, but the Avengers never looked down upon him. You know, it's not that he didn't have the stuff. It was just, you know, he was Peter Parker. He just, it wasn't, you know, that they weren't trying to humiliate him by saying, no, you're just a sidekick. It was just, they had their own team and they really didn't need whatever he was going to bring to it. They didn't need at that time. You know, the same thing with the X-Men, you know, way back in the Silver Age run, you know, when Spidey first shows up at the X-Mansion, you know, it wasn't, I think it had more to do with that fact that he wasn't a mutant, that they didn't invite him to join the team than anything else. So just that dynamic is so different than you look at, you know, the Teen Titans or, you know, a book like Young Justice. And, you know, like there is a delineation. Robin is a sidekick to Batman. And, you know, when Dick Grayson finally comes into his own, he doesn't become Robin on his own. He's just, now he's Nightwing.
Right.
You know, that's his persona. That's his non-sidekick persona. He has to completely change his identity because Robin is so tied up with being Batman's sidekick.
Now, and of course, this brings us right to your book. As far as like the sidekick goes, bringing up and creating these sidekicks, were they inspired by some of the DC sidekicks, or are they ones that you thought up originally? I just want to update people before we get into the new series.
Sure. So there, in the first volume, there are five main sidekicks that the story follows. There is Phantasm, Mustang, Jolt, Atlas, and Frostbite. And they are wholly my own creation. While their power sets might be similar to other characters that exist, that is more just a facet of, it's really difficult to come up with new and original powers that are going to work in an action hero book. So I wasn't paying homage with them. I wasn't basing them off of any pre-existing characters. However, the heroes that they worked for, absolutely, I was paying homage to the Justice League. Very, very much so.
Which really worked. I mean, as far as the thing goes, I thought the turn they took to go on strike was something. I mean, we would never, I'd never think of that. I mean, you obviously did. The notion to have them actually stop supporting the people who weren't treating them well, because I'm so used to Robin. I mean, you know, Robin dies at dawn. Robin, you know, this stuff. The reason why Batman had to wear multiple colored costumes was to distract people away from the fact that Robin was injured at the time. And so all these things were going on, and the whole business of a sidekick is, it reminds me very much of, there was an animated series with Batman and Robin and Batgirl, and Batmite was in it. And Batmite's job was to make sure we didn't get the story solved in 10 minutes. You know, he was there, and he just muffed things up along the way. And then at the end, they would get to the end, and the moral was always, don't take people for granted kind of stuff. And I when I read the book, it just sang to me in that way, because as far as people going and making things right, you know, how can you possibly treat somebody that's there to make you better the way that they did?
Right. And yet, I think probably anybody who's ever had a job can point to at least one manager, you know, one person they have worked under at some point in their careers. And that person has done exactly that. whether, you know, it's a nurse being treated poorly by the administration or by a doctor that they work with, whether it's a paralegal working with an attorney, or even if it's just, you know, a cashier at a store who's being treated poorly by management. You know, something very interesting. I have a couple of friends actually who work, they're cashiers, and they're not allowed to have a chair, you know, or a stool behind the register. They have to be standing. And, you know, these guys aren't necessarily in the best of shape. You know, they might be carrying a few extra pounds, and to have to stand for 8 hours is very difficult for them. And this notion that somehow they can't do their job without a stool, you know, and they go to their managers and say, hey, can we have a stool? And the manager says, no, you may not have a stool. What do you think we are? And that's crazy to me. Because the morale, the hit to morale that has to be is, you know, how did they not see that? Why would you treat people like that? And that was very much the story that I wanted to tell in that first volume, because it was something that I had personally experienced and suspected many, many people had also experienced. And that was exactly what I found out when it came time to promote the book. And, you know, finally, after it was published, selling the book, is once I gave people, you know, that elevator pitch, it clicked with them. You know, so many people said, oh, I had a boss like that once. Yeah, I want to get this book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just such a wonderful thing. And the choice of the characters, I think, is really good about that. And I do want to explore the first ones a little more.
Sure.
But I don't want to spoil too much, but we do need to see, you mentioned the fact that you didn't know what you would do in a second collection, and yet now here you are doing it.
Yeah, but of course it's 5 years later, so thankfully I had time to really sit down and plot it out, which was not easy. Because with the first one, it really just flowed right out of me, particularly that first issue. That first issue, I think it took me less than a week to script all 22 pages of it. And then the other three, it was originally supposed to be a 3-issue miniseries, but I had to expand it to 4. Because once I started writing the second, it was funny, I plotted out the second issue. And when I counted up the pages, I realized that the sidekicks, whose story this is, only appeared on 4 of the pages. Mm. And I realized, no, that's not right. I can't do that. Mm. So I had to expand it to 4 issues to make sure that the, you know, all of the characters got their own arc and that I could tell the complete story.
Well, one of the things I noticed on your Kickstarter page was the fact that you mentioned there's a disclaimer that says you don't need Volume 1 to understand or enjoy Chapter 5.
Yes.
But you will certainly have a greater experience if you've read it. And I have to say, if you haven't read it, my gosh, you need to read that book. It was just something. It was, you know, I always am interested when people say, well, there's nothing we can possibly do with superheroes anymore that we haven't done 100 times already. You found something that hadn't been done before, I don't think, in any real way. And you took that story and told it so well that I was just blown away when I read it.
Thank you. Yeah, you definitely don't need to read the first volume to pick up with Chapter 5 and continue. You know, just like I took a screenwriting class, and that was one of the things that the teacher hammered home. It's like, no matter what you're writing, and this is kind of old school comic book thinking too, is every issue could be somebody's first issue. So you have to give them the information that's necessary that they can enjoy that issue and continue without necessarily going behind it. Although obviously going behind it gives you, you know, the richer world, and it gives you just so much more information and character depth. But, I saw this very much as, you know, kind of a movie, you know, so this is now a sequel. What if people hadn't seen the first one? How can I get them the information that they need without making it just a complete retread and boring to the people who had already read the first volume? So absolutely, you can pick up with Chapter 5, but like you said, I wouldn't recommend it. You can, but absolutely pick up that first volume, because you really are going to get just so much more out of this new story if you have the stuff that came before it.
I see. One of the things I really liked about the way you told the story was that there was a lot of diversity in the characters, which I liked, because, you know, one of the things I've always noticed in sidekicks is that you don't get a lot of diversity. They're usually, you know, gosh, 14, 15 years old at the oldest. and they're usually white guys. But you didn't do that. You had, you know, people of different backgrounds and stuff like that involved, which I think made the story a lot more full and a lot more interesting. So talk about that. I mean, was that, when you started to do that, was that a real conscious choice of yours to make sure that everybody was, that there weren't all the same kind of things that we normally associate with sidekicks?
Yeah, so actually probably the best example of that, and it's not even one of the sidekick characters. One of the heroes has an Egyptian theme. And, you know, he's kind of my analog in terms of powers. He's my Green Lantern analog. But I thought, you know, instead of a lantern, he's got a scepter and he's got this Egyptian theme. And originally he was just going to be, you know, a white guy, because that's most of what the Justice League was. And since he was my Green Lantern and the Hal Jordan, is that right? Hal Jordan? God.
Yeah.
I'm going to lose my street cred here. You know, and Hal is a white guy. So that's just what he was going to be. But then I realized, oh, man, no, that's terrible. How can I have an Egyptian-themed character and not have an Egyptian or at least somebody of Arab descent, you know, being that character? You know, it just occurred to me, you know, the whitewashing of that. Just it didn't sit well with me. So I went back and I changed it. And so I made him, you know, of Egyptian descent. And then with the sidekicks, for me, it was just, you know, this is Chicago, you know, and not everybody's white in Chicago. You know, it's a pretty diverse city. And one of the characters I knew from the outset was going to be religious and Catholic. So it made sense that he would be Hispanic. And I really liked, you know, Walter is the assistant editor at the newspaper. And I thought, okay, what kind of character is really going to be involved with the paper? And when I started diving into Walter's backstory, which I wrote mostly for myself, just so that I could understand the character when I was writing the book, I realized that social justice was going to be, you know, this is why Walter goes into the media. You know, his parents were lawyers, and this is all stuff that is not in the book proper. It's all in the background for me. But he thought that he could do better influencing society through the print media than by becoming a lawyer like his parents were. And I thought the kind of person that that's going to be is an African-American, you know, somebody who grew up not with the privilege, you know, of the other white characters that are his friends and his coworkers. So Walter is far more grounded than the other sidekicks because of just his upbringing. And so that was also a conscious decision. But that came out as I was writing his backstory. You know, so it's not like I had a little quota. You know, I didn't have boxes to check. Okay, I need a white guy, and I need a, you know, a Hispanic guy, and I need a black guy. And that wasn't, you know, how I went into it. It was when I was figuring out who the characters were and could they work better as a non-white character, would that add, you know, it's always, is there value added in doing that? And as a, you know, and as a plain vanilla white guy myself, it's easy for me to just write characters as if they're plain vanilla white guys, because that's what I am. That's the experiences that I've had growing up, and it's easy to do it. But if I can add value to the character, and if I can add value to the story, it made sense for me to do it, and that's how that came about.
Mm-hmm. There's one other thing I think that about the first book that we need to talk about, so people can get as much as they can out of the second volume that's coming, is the fact that you kind of went a business direction, or a labor direction, shall we say. Maybe that's a better way to put it.
Yes.
Is the fact that they actually go on strike, and I think that's one of the things that the website brings out. The Kickstarter shows that quite strongly, is the fact that rather than continuing to take the abuse that they were taking, they decide to go on strike and not do that anymore. And, of course, you know, Chicago is kind of a union town. So I kind of figured that's probably what you're drawing on in order to make these things happen, is that this is the kind of thing we see. Because, see, I come to this, too. I grew up in a section of Pennsylvania, northeastern Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. where we always had teachers on strike. And I don't know, you know, they were forever striking so that they could get better wages, better hours, all kinds of stuff. And so many times during a school year, we wouldn't get the full year because they'd be on strike for parts of it. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw that, I was like, oh, man, I said, this is, you know, I can relate to this because I remember experiencing that kind of stuff and seeing people go through that kind of experience. So, I mean, was that the reason why you went that route with them?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to tell a labor story. I mean, that was definitely part of it. You know, mostly, let's see, this was when I started really writing this in the late 2000s, just as, you know, the economy really started to crumble and the financial global crisis was getting into swing. So this notion of worker protection, you know, as people were losing jobs left and right, telling a story about labor and, you know, the people at the bottom kind of banding together and drawing on strength from each other was definitely a conscious decision that I was trying to do. I very much wanted to tell that labor story. There's a reason that the villains in the first volume are known as the board of directors. It's they're individuals, you know, it's they're not a team. They don't go out working as a team, but they do all come together and collude to bring down the heroes of Chicago. You know, I saw them kind of as like the various mafia families in whatever cities, where there's different families, but there's also an organization there, you know, where they are not going to actively work against each other because that's going to hurt them in the long run. It's okay, there's this uneasy alliance among the bad guys of the city. And sometimes they're going to work together because it benefits everyone. And it occurred to me that that is very much the way big business will operate, you know, where businesses will set prices in such a way that, you know, this notion, you know, capitalism only works when competition is in play. But if the people who decide how much things are going to cost decide, no, we are going to agree that this is what this thing is going to cost, well, there goes the competition. And they create an unfair advantage. So I really liked giving that aspect to the villains in that book, and, you know, and naming them the board of directors, not to pat myself on the back because my wife doesn't like it when I do that, but I thought that was one of the more clever things I did.
And one of the things I also enjoyed about, I get a kick out of the book, was to see how things went after the sidekicks go on strike. Let's just say that they prove their worth because things don't go all that well for the Justice League, for want of a better term. And so that, I don't want to spoil how it ends because I think you should read the book, but it's really an interesting thing to watch how things develop and see where things go towards the end. And so I just loved that book. I so many people I knew were talking about that book all the time because they really loved it and loved the notion that, you know, standing up for themselves as the sidekicks were. And, you know, how many people do we know that really love Robin as opposed to Batman or stuff like that?
Right.
There are a lot of people who like that. And so to see sidekicks actually come into their own, basically, was really something nice to see and something very different. You know, it's like I said, you went a place I didn't expect you to go. And that's what I loved about the book, was the fact that it was something new. You were going in untrodden territory. And for me, that was just such an enjoyable thing.
Yeah, I was surprised that this, you know, kind of sidekicks, you know, teaming together and, you know, really working, they weren't so much working against their heroes, but the fact that they took this giant step back to say, all right, look, you're not going to give us the respect we deserve, then we're not going to help you anymore. It surprised me that really never existed in comic books.
Mm-hmm. It's really something. Now, this all leads, of course, to the second series.
Yes.
And one of the things I noticed about the second series right away was that you introduced a lot more female characters.
Yes.
In there. And I thought that was a nice move, you know, forward with that. Talk about that. I mean, bringing in the – because – see, one of the things I have trouble with female sidekicks is like when they had the Green Hornet and they had a female Kato, it's always got to be a romantic interaction with that. And so I always, when I usually see female sidekicks, my eyes roll to the back of my head. Oh, no, not that again. But you go a different route with that.
Yeah, so the biggest complaint I receive about this book, and it is a completely legitimate complaint, and you know I take it on myself. This is all, you know, my fault, is that you've got five main sidekicks in the first volume, in the first four chapters, and not a single one of them is a woman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is because, you know, like I said earlier, I am a guy and I write what's easy for me to write. And it's easy for me to write guys because I know how they think. And it just to put a girl on the team, I didn't know how I was going to do that. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me while I was kind of wrestling with this problem of, all right, do I just change one of the sidekicks to a girl? Do I add a girl sidekick? I realized that in comic books, there really is, there's this gender inequality. We don't have the same number of female superheroes, whether they're sidekicks or not, as we do the male heroes. You know, you see it in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know, it took 20 movies featuring the men before we got one that was led by a woman. Mm-hmm. And so the women really do get treated differently. So I thought, I asked myself while writing it, so can I create kind of a meta commentary? Mm-hmm. You know, does the absence of women actually create a commentary? And I realized, yes, it absolutely does. And that kind of comes to fruition, and not to give away too big of a spoiler, mm-hmm. for the first volume, mm-hmm. when the sidekicks are finally deciding whether or not they should get back into the game to help out the city of Chicago, the girls all disappear because you know there are female sidekicks in this world. There are some female heroes in this world. And when the sidekicks are all meeting, the girls are just gone. And there's a line in there where Phantasm asks, you know, where are all the girls? And it turns out they formed their own team. Mm-hmm. You know, they said, you know what, if we're going to do this, what do we need you boys for? Mm-hmm. And the girls stake out, you know, a section of Chicago and say, okay, this is our turf. We're going to, you know, run it ourselves. We don't need the boys involved. Mm-hmm. So that was how I handled it in the first volume. But I knew coming into the second volume that that wasn't going to be good enough. You know, I needed to introduce the female sidekicks. I needed to make them a bigger part of the story. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they show up in that first issue only because, you know, it's that act one and I'm trying to reestablish the world. And they are kind of off on their own in their own little section of Chicago. But by issue two, they show up, and then they, as the series progresses, and the second volume is a five issue story as opposed to a four issue of the previous volume. As the story progresses through the five issues, their role gets more and more important and bigger. And so that was a conscious choice. I knew I wanted to add them in. I knew I had to add them in, as it was the biggest criticism that I was getting as the writer and creator of the series. And that was actually a lot of fun too, because I don't really write female characters because I'm not a woman. So trying to get inside their heads and trying to say, okay, you know, what are their motivations and, you know, what would they do? Realism is important to me. You know, I don't want to just have some magical thinking, you know, and it's like, oh, well, you know, the characters are going to do this because they're just good. You know, this is a world filled with lawful good people and they're just going to do what is expected of them. No, that's not good. You don't want to write like that. So with the girls, it was, what are their motivations? You know, so they've staked out, you know, this one section of Chicago for themselves, mm-hmm. and they're perfectly happy to be there. And, you know, when their paths cross with the original sidekicks who've now, you know, kind of formed a super team, mm-hmm. You know, now you have this problem of competing teams, you know, so it's like, DC really doesn't have it, but kind of like if when the Avengers and the X-Men have problems, because mm-hmm. They're both operating out of New York and they don't necessarily are getting along all the time, but now they're clashing. It's like, okay. And that's kind of what's happens with the women's team and with the men's team. Because even the guys, the five main sidekicks wind up bringing in two of the former heroes that they worked with, mm-hmm. to form what I'm calling the cooperative. Hmm. that's, you know, kind of their team for the guy. And still, it's just seven guys now. So instead of five guys from the first volume, now they're seven guys. So, you know, what's the, that creates conflict. And again, it didn't make sense to, you know, all of a sudden have these romantic interests, because that's not an necessarily an interesting story. You know, romance can complicate things, but I think that because it wasn't set up in the first volume, it didn't make sense to try to shoehorn that in to the second.
So I hate that. I just, when I saw that Green Hornet and the female Kato, and then, and of course, you know, it's just like with Frank Miller's Batman, where Robin was a girl. You know, there's always seems to be, and even like with the animated series with Batman, they had Batman and Batgirl getting it on and stuff like that. And I remember
that was the in the Killing Joke, in the animated version of the Killing Joke, they added, you know, that scene between, you know, and that to me made no sense, because I certainly didn't remember it from the book, and I'm pretty sure it's not in the book.
It's not.
And it just seemed so unnecessary for that particular story. It's like, no, you don't need the romance to feel the bond between these two characters. And just, it was superfluous.
Yeah, I agree with you there, because I remember seeing that and being disappointed. I remember thinking, see, not all relationships, even when they're between male and female, are not necessarily romantic. There are people who are friends who are male and female and stuff like that. So to me, the underlying thing is that it must be a romantic relationship for male and female stuff. And that drives me up the wall. I mean, I think you're doing it the right way. I think you're introducing characters, and because of who they are, they get involved in what's happening. But it's not that they are titillated, shall we say,
right. That
things happen. It's because they are heroic and they are people who want to make good things happen that these things happen the way that they do. And so when I read that when I was looking over the script and stuff, I was like, wow, that's really going to be a neat thing. I don't know. I understand the criticism of that, but you know, you've got to be able to take a story and it's still got to grow naturally. And I think you did that with the first one. Yeah. It's easy to look back and say, well, there were no women in it and stuff, but you were making, and I know I'm, probably some of the female listeners are going to go nuts when I say this, but I think you're doing it the proper way, is to let it grow naturally, let it develop in a natural way to make these characters. And, you know, maybe somewhere down the road there will be some sort of romantic entanglements coming along the way, but it's not necessary. It's not going to move the story forward. I think it'd be a distraction.
Right. And that's why I didn't go back and change anything. You know, trying to change one of the five main sidekicks to be a woman would have just complicated the story beyond, because it's like you said, it just wouldn't have been organic. Mm-hmm. You know, it would not have made sense with the story that I was telling.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're doing the right way. You're letting the characters evolve. You're letting the situation evolve. It's moving in a direction, I think, that's going to be really fun to read, really interesting to read about that. Now, I don't know how much you want to tease about what kind of things you've got coming in the second story. You've given a little bit of, given us some idea as to what directions we're going to go with that. But are there other, like, hints? If somebody's interested and you go to the Kickstarter and you look things over, are there other little teases that you might want to give that wouldn't spoil the story that you're going to tell?
Sure. So the main conflict in this one, and this was actually the hardest thing for me to do, this is why it took so long to actually finish writing the sequel, was coming up with the main conflict, because I didn't just want it to be, you know, sidekicks versus heroes again. So I needed a bigger threat. And, you know, what's a bigger threat than an alien invasion? So that is the main thrust of this story, is aliens have come to Chicago. And our heroes don't know why the aliens are here. We don't know what it is they're trying to accomplish. All we know is they showed up one day and they are in a genetics laboratory and they've taken hostages and they are now out and about in the city and we don't know why. And they have, and of course, because they're aliens, as opposed to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where the aliens all speak English, these aliens do not. Mm. So we have no way of communicating with them. And that's the main conflict of the next five issues of this series, is trying to deal with this alien threat. And the team that has come over, the alien team, is superior in force and numbers to the current cooperative team of sidekicks and former heroes. So they're at a disadvantage. You know, the guys that we're rooting for are at a disadvantage, and that's I think the conflict that and trying to just figure out, you know, why they're there. It was funny. It's something my editor, I should probably mention, but you were only 40 minutes in, Darby Pop Publishing. You know, I used Kickstarter to fund and print the first four issues.
Right.
But then Darby Pop Publishing, while I was doing the Kickstarters, contacted me, said they really like what they saw, and would I be interested in going through them for the trade paperback? And so, you know, I talked to Jeff Klein over there, and so they published the trade, and it did very well. We sold through the first printing. We're about to sell through the second printing, which is one of the reasons why I went back to write the sequel, because I knew, you know, that there was a fan base and people wanted it. But so Jeff and was always, when I sent him the scripts over, he would keep asking me, are you sure you want the aliens to not have an English translation? Because I think that the readers are not going to know what's going on. I was like, no, Jeff, that's the point. You know, I don't want anybody to know what's going on. If we could understand the aliens, then we, the readers, are going to have such an unfair advantage over the characters, the heroes and the sidekicks. And it was important to me to maintain that, you know, that wall of separation between what was going on in the comic book and what we as readers were going to have access to. And I didn't want the readers to know more than the characters, because I wanted them just in the dark.
See, that's good storytelling to me. I hate it. This is one of the things that Star Trek did, was the Universal Translator. And on some levels, it made storytelling easier, but on other levels, it made it stupider.
Well, yeah, it's a matter of convenience, you know, especially in a show like Star Trek. You can't spend 20 minutes of the show with the two races learning how to communicate with each other, because it would literally have to be every single time they met a new, you know, kind of alien. And that would work every once in a while. You know, there's that brilliant episode, the name of which escapes me, where the one alien race, the translators don't work on them.
Right. Deep Space Nine. Yeah, I remember that one.
Right. So, you know, like that, every once in a while it works really well. But for the most part, especially when you're dealing with a TV show, you really can't do it. But in a comic book, so long as I can get across what the story is, and the purpose of keeping the translation secret adds to the story, you know, because it kind of deepens the mystery, then I think it's okay. I think it can work, because, again, it's adding value. You know, the fact that the readers don't know what the aliens are saying to each other adds value to the story. And I give a lot of credit to my penciler, Andre Portilla, because a lot of it falls then on his shoulders to have to kind of get across what is happening through the artwork. You know, you have to be able to look at the art to understand what's going on, even though you can't understand what they're saying. And I certainly couldn't do that, but he has been just crushing it. I'm so happy to have him on board. He's doing such a good job, and he really does a great job capturing the scenes and telling the story through his pictures. Because I'm a disciple of Claremont. You know, I'm a wordy guy, and I will, you know, fill up that page with dialogue, but I have to tell myself, you know, I'm like, okay, no, step back, let the artwork tell the story for you. You know, so that's usually by the time I'm kind of going over the third draft of my scripts is, okay, now what dialogue can I pull out and just let the artwork tell the story? And Andre has just been phenomenal on that front.
See, that's the kind of a thing I think that a true team can do. You can step back and let the artwork tell the story. You know, instead of having to, this is another thing that drives me crazy in comics. We have to have a box that tells us, unable to understand what was going on. They were not certain exactly what to do. And I'm like, why do we need that? Can't we just tell that from the picture? I mean, shouldn't the illustration tell us that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a very old school style of storytelling. And I think there's absolutely a place for it. But when I was approaching my book, I did want it to have a bit more of a modern feel to it. And I did want to, you know, and when I've got the caliber of artists that I have had the pleasure of working with on this series, I want to make sure that they can shine. They're not just drawing to provide a little bit of art to go along with my dialogue, but it's that they get to tell their story as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you answered one of the questions I was going to ask about was Darby Pop continuing to do that. Are they going to print out individual issues, or are they going to hold off and do the second collected edition? How's that going to work?
All right. So for listeners who don't know, because Darby Pop is a fairly small publisher, they deal in creator-owned works, and it's completed creator-owned works at that. So the way it will work with me is I need to finish the series. So I will do the individual issues myself through a series of Kickstarters. You know, so this Chapter 5 Kickstarter is just to get the printing done for Chapter 5. And then I'll eventually come back to do one for Chapter 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 eventually. And then when it's all finished, I can then present it to Darby Pop. And there's never a guarantee. You know, it's not like they've said, oh, yes, absolutely, if you do a second volume, we're going to publish. And if they do, it would be in a trade paperback form and not in the single issues. But I have to prove that, one, you know, I can get this thing finished, because that's important. But also, two, that not only is it good enough for publication, but that there is a market for it. You know, and the Kickstarters kind of prove all of those things.
Yeah, but you've also got the first volume to help prove that too.
Yes, and that's why, you know, and that's why part of this came about from Darby Pop, you know, Jeff Klein, you know, asking me, he's like, are you working on a sequel? Now, that conversation wasn't, hey, do a sequel so we can publish it. It was, this is selling very well for us. If you are working on a sequel, we would like to see it. You know, so it's kind of like they have a right of first refusal. You know, they get to see it first, or they kind of have the option on the second volume. So, you know, I do the single issues, and then if they like what they see when it is all said and done, they will come in and publish the trade paperback, and they'll do the, you know, the Comixology digital distribution, that kind of stuff, you know, because I can't get my own, I can't get a book into Diamond, but they can, you know, so that puts it on store shelves. And that's actually the really nice thing about the Kickstarter is because this is the only time these books are going to be printed as single issues, they're limited that way. You know, I think the first issue of the, you know, the first volume, that true issue number one, I think I only printed like 400 copies of that thing, all said and done. And it's never going to be printed again. You know, because now that the trade paperback exists, the only time we're going to reprint those first four issues is in trade paperback form. So if you have those single issues, well, good for you. You have an incredibly limited edition comic book.
Which, of course, collectors love.
I certainly hope so.
Well, I know they do, because I have run into so many people, indie publishers in particular, who always say you have to make sure that your collectors are very happy people. And, you know, I think that's this kind of thing will do that for a collector. They'll want to have something that's unique and a little difficult to obtain, and I think you're providing that for them. You know, you're telling a good story as well as making people on different levels happy with it. And I think that, you know, not many people in DC or Marvel can do that so much anymore. I think that the indie people have kind of come and stepped up to do those things. And you get to tell the good stories that we haven't seen before, and you get to make these people happy. And hopefully that'll mean you get to tell more of those good stories. So that'll be wonderful.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, it really is a pleasure. to be able to write. Because when I sat down, and started scripting that very first issue, I never thought, one, that I would be able to find somebody to draw it, let alone, have the thing published and go through Diamond and be in stores. But then for it to sell well enough to warrant a sequel, that never occurred to me. So to be in this position is actually really humbling. To go to a comic book convention and have somebody come to my table and say, I was here last year and I bought your book and I really, really liked it. Do you have any more? That is such a wonderful and humbling experience.
Well, I went to New York Comic Con. People had told me about the book, and I couldn't find it because, one of the bad things with indie comics is that sometimes the local stores don't want to get involved with those kinds of things. And I remember going to the Darby Pop booth, and I was going like, when are you getting those trades? When are you getting the issues? Where are they? And they didn't get them in time to be able to sell them at the convention. I remember being dejected as I left the business. And they said, we'll eventually have a trade. I said, eventually? I said, I want to read this story. I'm really interested in this. And so when it came around in trades, I think that's when I finally got the thing and sat and read it. And I was just so happy with it. Because like I said, it's something that we haven't dealt with. And it's low-hanging fruit if you think about it. And I'm so glad you were able to put that all together and make that happen. Because this book is, I could see, I bet you could come up with several more stories to tell now that you've started this.
It's funny because it's definitely a universe that could, this series, it's funny. Originally, it was titled Sidekicks, but that was too similar to J. Michael Straczynski's Sidekick, which came out right around the same time. So Darby Pop actually asked me to change the title, and that's how we came up with Sidekicked. And now I've forgotten where I was going with that. I apologize to your listeners. I was about to say something really interesting.
You got to do now is you got to buy the book to find out what the story is all about.
Now I remember. It was okay. This series could, Sidekicked could very much be an ongoing. I think if somebody had the means, because when the artwork for these things, I have to pay my artists up front. And it's anywhere from between $4,000 and $5,000 per issue. Mm-hmm. And I don't have that lying around. So it does take me, time and Kickstarters to get those funds raised. Mm-hmm. But this could be an ongoing series. Hmm. But because of the nature of the financials, I have to do it in volumes. And then because I'm doing it in volumes, I have to tell complete stories because it's very important to me that if you pick up the volume one trade paperback, you're getting a complete story and you're not getting to the end of, that trade at the end of that fourth chapter and it's a giant cliffhanger and you have no idea what's going to happen next. And now you have to wait 5 years to get the next thing. It was very important to me that when I tell a story, it's complete. And so that you can enjoy that book as a book and you don't need, you don't necessarily need what comes next. If you want what comes next, great. And hopefully you'll enjoy that one too. But if you wanted to stop there because that was the only one you have, then you could stop at that book. So it's the same thing with chapters 5 through 9 and the second volume was I wanted to make sure I'm telling a complete story. So it's like you said, could this continue? Absolutely. The characters are there. The world is there. For me, it's a matter of the financials and making sure that because we're doing it, everything is a trade paperback. We are telling this complete story.
Well, it's worth the wait. All I can say is the first one, really, I couldn't wait to get my hands on the book. When I got to read it, I was so happy with it. I was just really enjoyed it. And that's why I got to talk with you. And I get to talk with you again because this Kickstarter is underway. And my understanding is that the Kickstarter will conclude on Tuesday, July 16th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time.
That's right.
So you're off to a good start, and of course we're recording this a little ahead of time too, so I don't want to give numbers and stuff because it's probably going to change hopefully will change pretty significantly by the time
right
post, because like I said, I've already pledged, and if anybody read the first volume, I highly encourage you to get involved with the second volume, and if you haven't, you can still catch up and enjoy it. So it's called Sidekicked, and there's a hyphen in there, Side-Kicked. and it's great stuff. It's things that I never dreamed of, and luckily you did, to talk about sidekicks and aliens and more and heroes and things like that. So it's just one of those great books that I just cherish. This is why indie books are such a treasure so much of the time. We get to read stories that you're telling us that are just fantastic and wonderful, and I have no idea where you're going, and that's part of the fun. I don't know what you're going to do with this, but boy, even after I got to read a little bit of the first issue of this volume, I don't know what you're going to do, but boy, that makes it all the more fun for me to read. So
yeah, funny story. My editor wasn't sure where I was going with it either. it wasn't until I turned in that final issue that he said, "Ah, okay, this is going to work." So I was like, wait, you didn't think it was going to work before this issue?
Well, look at the first trade, for pity's sake. You see, the first one worked. You know, the same guy's telling the story, so it ought to work. And sure enough, I'm really looking forward to seeing how this comes together. So it's just a great stuff. I'm so happy to see more of this. You know, if you ever get a chance to do more of these kinds of story, Russell, I want to see more of it, because, you know, even I'm feeling that same excitement just reading what I have and being, you know, getting to explore the sidekick universe again. So, man, I'm so happy that you're doing it, and I'm so looking forward to get to read these good things, because, man, it's going to be great fun.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this week. Be back next episode when I'll have another terrific conversation with another wonderful comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.